Hello and welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Seoul Dotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm your host, Bill Howell. As always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. Got a good show for you this month with a couple of interesting interviews, but as always, let's get started with beer news. The 2024 Kenai Peninsula Beer Festival was another great success, despite having to endure rain during the event. This year, 20 breweries participated, from Anchorage to Juneau and Talkeetna. Most of the companies at the beer festival make, well, beer, but wineries, cideries, and meaderies were also represented. This year's festival raised more than $20,000 to support local Rotary Club projects. Newcomer Susitna Brewing won the People's Choice Award for Best Brewery and Best Beer at the festival. I'll be interviewing Susitna's brewer, Sarah Perez, later in today's show. This year's Capital Brew Fest will be held on September 28th in Juneau from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Centennial Hall Convention Center. This is the 12th annual Capital Brew Fest, with all proceeds going to the Rotary Club of Juneau. There will be an Oktoberfest celebration in Valdez on September 20th and 21st. The festival will be held on Galena Drive and will include local food, beer, vendors, and a homebrew contest. Find it on Facebook or Instagram. 49th State Brewing will be holding its annual Oktoberfest event on Saturday, September 14th at its pub in Anchorage. It will feature live German music from Alaska Blaskapelle, a German food menu, special German-style beer releases, and live music from Last Frontier Llamas. The event runs from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. There's a $5 entry fee, and the first 1,100 people through the door will receive a free 1-liter stein. From noon on Saturday, October 5th to midnight on Sunday, October 6th, Humpy's Great Alaskan Ale House in Anchorage will be celebrating its 30th Oktoberfest. This beloved event promises a lively atmosphere filled with authentic German food, craft beers, live music, and a variety of family-friendly activities, attracting locals and visitors alike to join in the celebration of culture and community spirit. The 9th annual Hoodoo Choo Choo Train Trip will be taking place on Saturday, September 28th. The event is already sold out, so if you don't already have your tickets to this Fairbanks event, you are out of luck. Anchorage Brewing has released its first year-round statewide distributed local IPA, the appropriately named Anchorage Hazy IPA. This beer will not be available at the brewery, but only at local liquor stores, bars, and restaurants. Four packs of cans are currently available at Country Liquors in Kenai. This IPA is brewed with tons of malted oats and heavily dry hopped with Nelson Sauvin and Strata hops, and weighs in at 6.4% alcohol by volume. Well, that's it for this month's beer news. Up next, we'll have an interview with Sarah Perez, the brewer for Susitna Brewing Company. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Seoul Dotna.
KDLL, the Peninsula Clarion, and League of Women Voters are teaming up again to offer live candidate forums August 26th through October 29th at a library near you. Attend in person, tune in to KDLL, stream us at kdll.org, or the Clarion's Facebook page. Find the full schedule at kdll.org. Email questions for the candidates to info@kdll.org.
Sarah Perez from Susitna Brewing Company. Hello, Sarah. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you.
Well, hey, thanks for being on our show. So first up, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about you, your background? How did you end up as a commercial brewer at Susitna Brewing Company?
I've been in the beer industry for just over 16 and a half years now. I started off in Las Vegas, Nevada, just kind of as a beer nerd, consumer, a lot of what normal people, you know, in our industry definitely are all about, and quickly became obsessed with beer. I started a bottle sharing club, if you would. We called ourselves the Share Bears. And we would hang out every Sunday at Tenaya Creek Brewing Company in Las Vegas, Nevada. And we just continued to flourish about talkings and about beers. And we'd get beers from all over. Sometimes we would do rattlers. And we do like, you know, today was just going to be all about an IPA, but this is the ABV, this is the IBUs, and then we're going to press it through on our rattlers. And we would just do different types of ingredients with that and see what those types of beers tasted like. And sometimes we would just sit and talk about sours for hours, and Sismontane and so many other wonderful breweries that are out there in the world that you don't necessarily really get to see up here in Alaska. But I mean, down there, we definitely had a smorgasbord at our fingertips all times. So as that kind of grew, there was some women that were in the group with me, and we just decided that we noticed there was a distinct difference between our male counterparts and our flavors and our palates and the way that we noticed different things. And from there, it sparked a need for me to start a all women's nonprofit group. And we went with the existing group that's in the lower 48, or used to be in the lower 48, called Barley's Angels. And Barley's Angels was an offshoot from Pink Boots, where you didn't have to necessarily be in the beer industry at that time. You didn't have to make a certain amount of money. You didn't really have to do much of anything, but you did have some criteria that you always wanted to meet. You always wanted to meet together in a brew pub and a brewery or things like that. And you wanted to have food as your counterbalance so that you could understand the pairings between those two types of things. And specifically, it was all mostly women. And so we started that group and we grew it really large. We would start going to all kinds of events. We started doing home brewing and we started teaching home brewing to other women and paired up with some bottle shops in Las Vegas. And I mean, from there, it just felt like it was just like a natural progression. My fun time job, I always called it back then. I worked for a craft brew pub that had over 50 different taps on rotation all the time. On top of that, they also had two different restaurant locations. They were a scratch kitchen. It allowed me to flourish into the Cicerone realm and just really enlighten my mind and my my background on what I really loved and didn't love in a growing industry. And this was, you know, like I said, 16 years ago. So there really wasn't a lot of breweries in Las Vegas, and what we had around us didn't always meet our palate. So we sought out different places and different things all the time. So it just kind of grew from there. And then about 9 years ago, my husband's in the Air Force and we got stationed up here in Alaska. And when I moved up here, I made it my vow to work for Gabe Fletcher. And I did. And just from there, it just kind of escalated from doing nonprofit work and education-based information to others that were in the craft industry or didn't really know that much about craft, and just kind of escalated into me learning how to homebrew, and then escalating from homebrewing to small batch brewing, and then from small batch all the way up to production. And along the way, I've grown an education base. I've gone to Siebel Institute. I've done my Master Distillers program. I have certifications in both of those realms, and I continue to be a mentor for the Brewers Association for their mentorship program as well. And I've collaborated and brewed with nearly all our breweries here in Alaska. I brought Pink Boots Society up here in 2020, where Alaska finally was recognized, and we had our own Pink Boots Society group, which is a nonprofit organization that is worldwide. And we collaborated and brewed all over the place with different women and non-binary women, different people of interest here in Alaska. And we did it, and all of those profits typically go back into the Pink Boots chapters for education bases and for help to encourage further knowledge in the craft beer industry. And actually now it's part of kombucha world and wine and spirits and everybody in between too.
Cool. Why don't you describe your operation there at Sisseton a little bit?
Yes, they opened a couple years ago. In the very beginning, they just had a small cafe side. In the last year and a half, they've been able to open up the big restaurant side. So it's this magnificent facility that's literally on South Lake side of Big Lake Shores. And it's a 20 barrel ABE semi-automated brew house. I have a three-vessel facility that I work on. And then I also have five regular fermenters, which are 40-barrel fermenters. And I have a bright tank in the front. And then in the back in our cold room, I have five serving storage vessels, if you would. And those are about 25 barrels. Those are 25 barrels. They are. And we have a canning line. We run canning runs all the time. We have seven wheelhouse beers, if you would. And it does definitely seem like a lot. But with canning during this winter time, it helps kind of keep the production going, and we can get it all over to Alaska. And it's really fun. You know, it's fun to be in a place where they're still learning and they're starting off, and to help them kind of mitigate some of that transitional parts where you're distributing your beers and you need to have production at a certain ramp up, and you're not just brewing a one barrel batch or something that is just going to, you're only going to sell your cans in stock in the brew house itself. So we distribute through specialty all over the state of Alaska.
Yes, we've started getting your beers in down here, so I think they're being pretty well received. Yes. So what's your favorite beer among your flagship brews?
I think the Hazy IPA is one of my favorites. When I brewed over on the East Coast, I found the Hazy IPAs to be way more inviting than I did ever being on the West Coast or in Texas region. I think the East Coast, brewers definitely understand the soft tones that it takes to have for the hop profile and then also for your grain profile. And I love the way that we've put that together in this recipe. So that was one of those ones where they had brewed several different ones. And then when I came on, I was like, hey, you know, this is the way that I would do it when I was over on the East Coast. And this is really going to help us hone in some of like our, you know, our Alaska West Coast kind of Alaskan style hazies that you typically see here. But this will really bring in all of that flavoring and that hop utilization. And, you know, it really helps with the beer itself to soften it out and gets it. It's definitely one of our bigger, more faster paced moving beers right now.
So what do you like most about being a brewer, and what do you like the least?
Oh, what I like the most, creativity, a sense of still growing and brewing and creating something that, you know, I don't have to necessarily let everyone know, hey, I'm the head brewer here, or I'm the person, or any of those types of things you just hear other people commenting when you're at a restaurant or a bar or something like that. And, you know, they're like, oh, I really love this beer, and, you know, talk about it that way, and just never really needing to say, oh, that's mine. You know, I don't wear some sort of an ego or a big head on my shoulders. I just love this industry, and I love creating craft beers and craft spirits and everything in between. Something that I hate, I think that there's still a huge unrecognized premise when, you know, we're working in an industry like this that has always been kind of male driven, and being a female in it is, you know, people are always taken aback, like, oh my gosh, you can do that? Or I had no idea that you were capable of doing something like that. And it's like, yes, I'm very capable of doing these things. So, you know, and it's a small community here in Alaska. So you're known, and, you know, people say nice things sometimes about you, and they say not nice things about you. And so that, I think that that's one of those things where, you know, you have to have that tough skin and that extra shield of, you know, you're okay, you're doing what you're supposed to do, you're doing it really well, and people are enjoying that. So I think that that would be those two things. Yeah.
Any plans to venture into the barley wine realm?
Matt, the owner, he absolutely does want to create a barley wine. Whether there will be a barley wine at this year's Barley Wine Festival from Susitna Brewing, I highly doubt that. It is far too late in the year to even think about creating a barley wine that's going to be able to hold up in to everybody else's barley wines here in Alaska. And I have been able to be a judge for that festival a few times in my history. And I not right now, not right now. We don't have a recipe that is solid enough that is going to bring us through to that support system, but definitely in the future, it is something that Matt wants, and he does appreciate big vivacious stouts and barley wines, and creating that really nice barrel aged backbone that you would want and expect from a barley wine from Alaska, for sure. But not yet.
Have you got any new releases coming out in the next few months?
Yeah, we actually, I just kicked up a honey blueberry chocolate stout that I created this almost 2.5 months ago. And we're going to be getting that out and going this weekend, actually. And then we've been playing around with some milkshake IPAs. Some will be fruited, some won't, just different recipes, kind of putting that out there. We do have an ask a lot for hazy IPAs. Since we only carry one hazy IPA, we're slowly getting maybe one or two other ones, but you won't see that. And then on First Friday, I have the debut of Susitna's first Saison. One of the beers that I've made in the past that is in my personal recipe repertoire. I've made it other breweries that I've worked for and other places across the board at Maui Brewing Company and every place in between. So it's a hibiscus saison. It's coming in at 9.8%. So it's definitely on that imperial side. It has wonderful balance. It has great carbonation, of course, but also the flavors are going to have this mango apricot, just true saison esters all coming through, along with the hibiscus and the tone of the color. And I'm really excited and very proud about this one. So this is going to be something that they can create continuously. We'll make it in a lower ABV form in the spring, and then towards the winter and summer winter months, we'll kind of do this imperial portion of it. So
sounds cool. Yeah. And you're going to can that and get it out for
there's folks? Not going to be any cans. Okay. You could definitely do it in a crowler formation, but we won't be doing this in a can. Maybe at some point they might do maybe a bottle arranging of something like this. And maybe, you know, once we get some more stouts under our realm and we have some more of these, then we'll have something special that'll come out, but not in can formation, okay. Not in a saison.
So where do you see yourself in the brewery there in about 5 years, looking ahead?
Well, I know that Matt and Whitney, they are going to be in great hands. We are going to find them their forever brewer. It is not going to be Sarah Perez. That's a definitive thing. I will be opening my own facility in my ranch in Texas in the near future and the next year and a half. And I won't be here. I'll come and snowbird and do the rest like everybody else, but I'll have my own brew distillery and taqueria on our 38 acres of ranch southeast of Austin. So In 5 years, I will be my own person in my own facility.
Well, Austin's a great town.
It is. And we're far enough away from Austin, the major parts of the city. We're in the rolling hills of Austin. So kind of think Jester King in a way. Yeah.
All righty. Well, hey, Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to talk to us. I appreciate it. Congratulations again on winning the People's Choice for both brewery and beer at the festival. Which beer did you win for? That's one piece of information I didn't get.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. So it was our barrel-aged roasted coconut caramel vanilla stout.
Okay.
And that was an oatmeal stout base that was aged in Port Chilcoot's rye whiskey barrels.
Okay.
So, yeah. And then I took that out, put it in the fermenter, and actually just condition it on all of the other ingredients, did a vanilla caramel reduction, and then roasted the coconuts here in our ovens and put everything back together. And it came out quite well. Yeah.
Well, again, congratulations. And
thank you.
Thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to us, and really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Cheers, Bill. Thank you.
All righty. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment.
Celebrate local food at the Harvest Moon Local Food Festival, Saturday, September 21st at Soldotna Creek Park. from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., enjoy farm and food vendors, demonstrations, kids' activities, a pie baking contest, the famous fermentation station, and live music featuring the Kenai Peninsula Brass Band at 5 p.m. KenaiLocalFood.org for details. This message sponsored by Kenai Local Food Connection with support from Tote Maritime.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. For our feature this month, we're going to do a short history of Guinness. Guinness, the iconic black pint with a creamy white clerical collar and a flash of ruby in its depths. But while Guinness is famous and consumed worldwide, half the world knows a very different kind of Guinness to the drink the other half swallows. In Ireland, the drink's original home, North America, and Europe, Guinness Draft is the familiar friend to lovers of creamy stout. Served in a pint glass, it has an initial surge of bubbles that gradually settle out into the familiar deep, dark body and blonde head. In Africa and Asia, drinkers are much more familiar with an older style of Guinness beer known as foreign extra stout, which comes in bottles, is almost twice as strong as draft Guinness, and has a powerful tart flavor that's surprisingly refreshing in a hot climate. The story of Guinness is the tale of how one small and run-down brewhouse on a street lined with other breweries grew into what was, for a long time, the biggest brewery in the world. Many drinkers know that Arthur Guinness, the founder of the company, acquired the brewery at St. James Gate in Dublin, Ireland, in 1759 when he was 35. However, the St. James Gate Brewery goes back almost a century before that. Its first known occupant was Giles Mee, who was paying hearth tax on a property at St. James Gate in 1663 and was brewing on location by 1670. The breweries at St. James Gate passed to Mee's son-in-law, Mark Rainsford, and then to a Huguenot family of French settlers called Espinasse. In 1750, then-owner John Espinasse was thrown from his horse near Drogheda, some 30 miles north of Dublin, and, depending on which newspaper report you read, either fractured his skull or broke his neck, dying instantly. St. James Street was a popular thoroughfare with brewers thanks to the several watercourses that ran across it down to the Liffey, Dublin's main river. As early as 1804, a city directory listed 8 breweries on the street. Despite this, the St. James Gate premises appear to have remained empty for 9 years after John Espinasse's death until Arthur Guinness came along in 1759 to sign his now famous 9,000-year lease. The drinks that Dublin breweries were making at the time were table beers and a strong, lightly hopped brown ale. However, they were suffering increasing competition from imports of English porter, the aged, well-hopped brown-black beer that had originally been developed to appeal to the working classes of London, but which had found a market around the world. Dublin's brewers responded by brewing porters themselves from the 1760s onward. Exactly when Arthur Guinness first made a porter is not known, but he was probably doing so by 1779, when he was appointed one of the 2 official suppliers of ale and beer to Dublin Castle, the seat of the Irish government, and definitely by 1784, when he was specifically fingered as the supplier of porter to the castle. Guinness was still making the traditional Dublin brown ale as well. Early in 1799, the decision was made to stop brewing brown ale completely. From then on, Guinness would be a porter and stout specialist. Arthur Guinness I died 4 years later in 1803, aged 78, and the brewery was inherited by his second son, the appropriately named Arthur Guinness II. He was already brewing a special, stronger, and more heavily hopped West India porter, which eventually developed into what is known today as foreign extra stout. By 1810, Guinness was brewing what he called a superior porter, quote, a stouter kind of porter, made only from November to May. Around the same time, Guinness began brewing an even stronger beer, extra superior porter, also known as double stout, about a third stronger than its standard country porter and with a higher hop rate. Extra superior porter was stored for 5 months or more to mature before being bottled the summer after it was brewed. This beer became particularly popular in Britain. By 1840, Extra Superior Porter, eventually renamed Extra Stout, made up 4 out of every pints brewed at St. James Gate. Helped by the success of Extra Stout, from the 1860s onward, Guinness grew and grew. It eventually dominated Ireland, making big dents in the British market, and became the largest brewery in the world. By 1890, sales were 688,000 barrels of porter a year, 99.8% of it in Ireland, 613,000 barrels of extra stout, 51% of it in Britain, and another 80,000 or so barrels of foreign extra stout. The brewery produced 8 tons of excess yeast daily, sold for £8 a ton to Irish whiskey distillers. The First World War hammered beer drinkers as the British government, which still ruled Ireland, raised taxes and pushed down beer strength to discourage drinking and save grain. When the war started, Guinness Porter had an original gravity of 1058, while the Extra Stout and Foreign Stout had an original gravity of 1073. By the end of the war, Extra Stout was reduced to 1049, while the Porter was at 1036. Only the foreign extra stout kept its original strength. One result was that in Ireland, drinkers began switching to extra stout, and Guinness Porter fell from around one-third of sales in 1913 to little more than an eighth by the late 1920s. In 1932, Guinness decided that it needed to open a brewery in England. A site was chosen at Park Royal in northwest London, and the brewery opened in 1936. But only after the plant at Park Royal was supplied with extra stout brought over from Dublin in order to mature the new wooden fermenting vessels and vats. This was an effort to reproduce the microbiological climate the company believed was essential to give Guinness its unique flavor. In 1849, Arthur Guinness II had set up 2 of his nephews, Edward and John Burke, as bottlers, and their firm, E&J Burke, subsequently became the largest importer of Guinness in North America. In 1934, after Prohibition ended, E&J Burke opened a brewery in Long Island City, New York, where it brewed its own ale and stout, as well as continuing to distribute Guinness. The Guinness sold in the United States was the foreign extra stout, still at 1073 original gravity, bottle-conditioned, heavily hopped, and high in acidity. It appealed only to connoisseurs. In 1943, Guinness bought out E&J Burke, including its Long Island brewery, and in 1946, it decided it should brew the lower-hopped, less acidic extra stout in Long Island for the American market. However, this would not be the modern extra stout. Instead, the plan was to recreate in Long Island the extra stout as it had been brewed in Dublin before the First World War at the same high gravity as foreign extra stout, but with a lower hop rate and less acidity. The Long Island brewery began producing this retro extra stout in 1948, tweaking the brew slightly the following year to be even more like foreign extra stout. Sales of Guinness in the United States doubled to 16,000 barrels a year, but this was barely half of the 30,000 barrels a year needed for the brewery to cover its operating cost. The problem was a taste profile that just did not match the American mass market in the late 1940s, which liked its beer cold and pale. The Long Island brewery closed in 1954. Meanwhile, in Britain, Guinness was trying to improve the market for draft stout by putting the beer into metal containers. The traditional way to serve draft Guinness, porter or stout, was from 2 separate casks, known as the high cask and the low cask. For the high version, stout was racked into an especially strong cask and left for 24 hours. Then it was blended with a quantity of unfermented wort and yeast, which kicked off a new fermentation. 10 days later, a foamy, creamy beer with considerable carbon dioxide condition was the result. When delivered to pubs, the high cask was placed on a stylage above the low cask, which contained older, flatter beer. Publicans would fill a glass 3/4 with beer from the high cask and then top it up from the low cask with the flatter beer to achieve, when everything settled, the classic black pint with a tight white head. Guinness had used white American oak to make its casks. However, imports to Ireland of oak for making new casks stopped at the beginning of World War II, and even after the end of the war, foreign exchange problems meant a lack of dollars to buy supplies from the United States. Thus, in 1946, the brewery began experimenting with putting stout in casks made of steel. Publicans and drinkers quickly found the steel containers manufactured in Germany and nicknamed by pubgoers iron lungs, after the mechanical devices used to assist polio victims to breathe, delivered a more consistent, creamier pint with a long-lasting head than the wooden casks, and the Dublin drinking fraternity began to ask for a pint from the lung. Guinness recognized that serving stout from metal containers was the way forward, but the high cask and low cask method, even with steel casks, was still laborious and awkward. A team at Park Royal in London, led by a man called Michael Ash, worked for 4 years on the problem. They eventually realized that the way to get the same creamy head that so delighted drinkers of Guinness served up the traditional way was to use nitrogen pressure, which produced tinier, more long-lasting bubbles in the beer with just enough carbon dioxide to give it some bite. The result, launched in 1959, was the Easy Serve system, a double-chamber aluminum keg with the piston gases in the top and stout in the bottom. With tweaks and improvements, the system invented by Michael Ash is still the way Guinness Draft is served today. It was also the first of what has become a new category of nitro beers. At the same time, Guinness was developing technology that would enable its other popular version to be brewed and consumed more widely. The flavor of foreign extra stout was originally due to its long maturation, which let Brettanomyces yeast and lactic bacteria give the beer an estery tartness that drinkers found highly refreshing. However, that took a year or more in storage in giant wooden vats, and time is money. Two Dublin brewers invented a method of concentrating the matured beer so that a small quantity could be added to freshly brewed stout to give it all the flavor of beer that had spent 12 months in a deep, cool cellar. Eventually, Guinness realized that highly concentrated Guinness flavor extract could be added to any beer, even a pale lager, to turn it into something indistinguishable from a long-matured foreign extra stout. In the 1960s, the company opened a brewery in Nigeria, which had long been one of the biggest markets for Guinness, and shipped out extract from Dublin to be added to a pale beer brewed there to create a foreign extra stout for the Nigerian market. It was highly successful and eventually helped Guinness expand overseas. With the help of the brewery's inventive process, Guinness is now brewed in 49 countries. Through all those technological changes, however, Guinness's emphasis has always been on delivering great taste to customers as much as, or more than, the money-saving tactics used to cut corners that seem to characterize other brewing giants. For that, Guinness, which is now part of a giant beverage conglomerate, Diageo, still earns some kudos. Brooklyn Brewery co-founder Stephen Hindy said, quote, "Of all the mass-marketed beers in the world, I think Guinness is the one beer most respected by America's craft brewers. Its understated marketing and commitment to flavor, quality, and presentation have been an inspiration for craft brewers." It is possible Arthur Guinness would not recognize the beer sold in his name as a descendant of his original porter. He would be astonished to discover, for example, that brown malt is no longer mashed with pale malt, but Guinness Stout starts off as a purely pale wort, and the color comes from roasted barley boiled separately, with this black extract added at the kettle stage. But he would enjoy the creamy head and the touches of coffee and chocolate that can be found in the depths of draft Guinness, and he would probably be fascinated by the surge and settle of the nitrogen pour. Today, the company is finding that, with so many beer drinkers constantly looking for something new, having one brand, no matter how legendary and entrenched, is not necessarily enough. It has introduced new lines, bringing back a beer called West Indies Porter, making a milk stout, and dabbling in IPAs. However, without a doubt, Guinness has been the gateway stout for many drinkers, their first experience of the dark side of beer, and it still represents, in many ways, the platonic ideal of a dry stout. There can be no brewer in the world who's brewed a stout and does not think somewhere in the back of their mind, how does this compare to Guinness? Up next, we'll have our second interview of the show with John Burkett of the Country Malt Group. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
The Kenai Watershed Forum's Fireside Chats are back at Kenai River Brewing this fall. Join the Watershed Forum Wednesdays, October 2nd through November 6th at the Kenai River Brewing Fire Pits to learn about a variety of topics. They're free and open to the public. The full lineup of speakers is available at kenaiwatershed.org.
Hello, John. How are you doing today?
Just fantastic.
So, hey, why don't you tell folks what it is you do when you're a rep for a malting company?
Sure. Name of the company is Country Malt Group, and we are a worldwide distribution company for anything a brewery needs, malted barley being the main thing, but we sell everything, hops, chemicals, yeast, kegs in some point. I mean, you name it, we sell it. We also have a distilling division, so anything that a distillery would need. We represent and we actually own the mothership owns not only Country Malt Group, we own Great Western Malting out of Vancouver, Washington. We own Canada Malting all over Canada. We own Baird's in Scotland. And then we distribute a wide range of other things. And actually, we're a part now of this group called Maltiery Soufflé, who bring us Castle Malt out of Belgium and Durst out of Germany and Czech Malts and a bunch of stuff. They were the largest maltster in Europe and Asia. We were the largest maltster in North America and I think Australia. So now that we're together, we're the largest maltster in the world. So that just brings a multitude of malts, mostly from Europe, that we didn't have access to before. Being in the Northwest, Alaska, Great Western is our flagship. And it's kind of funny, on the East Coast, Canada Malting is the flagship because the Montreal malting plant has been going for a long time supplying the East Coast. And so it's kind of interesting how that works. The thing that's starting to blend is our largest malt house is actually in Pocatello, Idaho. And we have a relatively new product called Pure Idaho, and it's a Pilsner malt with low protein levels. And it's not only big on the West Coast, but it's gaining traction on the East Coast. Both companies have a lot of, you know, we're talking about Oktoberfest coming up. Both companies have, all kinds of Vienna malts and Munich malts, but we also represent best malts from Germany. So we've got some great products from them, traditional German style. So just a wide range of anything you need. Hop-wise, we're Yakima Chiefs. We rep them. Got a lot of great yeast companies. The big trend now are dry yeasts because you don't have to worry about how it's stored. You don't have, being in Alaska, you don't have to worry about it getting ruined on the way up here, which used to happen quite a bit. And just amazing things. In fact, we just came out with a new sour from AB Biotech that, you can just use that yeast and not have to have cool ships or kettle sours or anything. It's just an amazing product, and it's just coming out like this week.
Well, if you would, take a minute and explain to folks how malt is made. I've covered this in the past occasionally on the show, but sure, you've got a better grasp of it than I do. So why don't you just describe people when you talk about making a Munich malt or something like that, what okay. does that entail?
So we're lucky that we get barley from, not only all over the world, but our main places for Great Western Malt is Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And we've got a malting plant in Vancouver, Washington, and in Pocatello, Idaho and, of course, all over Canada. But we buy the barley from the farmers. I mean, it's kind of bizarre doing this for, I think, 7 years after being a distributor. You realize you're dealing with farmers. In fact, the Maltieri Soufflé, that ownership group, are farmers, are French and Belgian farmers. And so we buy, you know, the barley from the farmers and kind of going way out. I'm lucky that I report directly to our head malting scientist for North America. And so any questions I have for malt, he's right there. In fact, every year at the Alaska Brewers Guild trade show meetings, which are coming up mid-November, he does the barley report on what's going on with barley all over the world. So it comes into our facilities, and there it's malted. And, you know, at some point you can even look up, I think, on our website, countrymalt.com, and go to Great Western and just see these, you know, these huge silos and these big beds of grain and how they're heated and, you know, malted, and, you know, it germinates. And it's just, it's really interesting. And then to make the different specialty malts, these are mostly kiln malts, and, you know, they just go in at various temperatures. And it's fascinating to watch the intricacies of how it happens. I really don't know, but it is pretty amazing. And you know, we try and have forecasts out so the maltsters know how to vary each roast and the different things they're going to do to create the different styles. And I'm just amazed on it. Just like how some of these breweries can make, you know, 18, 20 different beers and keep them up all the time. I don't know how any of these maltsters can keep so many different, you know, grains coming just basically from the same barley field. And then it's all the tricksters in the malting plant, just like us in the beer vision talk about how, you know, wine versus beer. Wine is, you know, in the field, and then it comes in and there's some blending, where, you know, beer is all the magic is in the brewery. You know, they get the same ingredients and do these different recipes. So it's the same idea.
I always laugh, you know, when the wine, they talk about, oh, it was a bad year, the grapes weren't right, or that we didn't get the right weather. Brewers don't get to use that excuse. They're supposed to be able to brew a good beer every year, regardless of what the weather was, with the hops or the malt, the grain, the barley. They can't use the excuse to say, oh, it was a bad year, that's why my beer doesn't taste good.
And but, it's a big issue, especially a couple of years ago when the protein levels were so high and so the yields were so low. And, you know, it just, you had to be a magician to make it work. And one of the things that we did, Country Malt Group, because a lot of this stuff, especially coming off Canada, you know, was so high, we imported some Danish malts just to blend in Montreal to try and get the protein levels down. And one of the malts that we do not carry that has a huge name, and that's Weyermann. And it's, you know, it's a wonderful German malt, although they source their grain from all over Europe, just not Germany. Our best malts is pretty much all Germany. But anyway, they're comparable products. But Weyermann is just a big name. And people that are big Weyermann fans, they don't care what else is on the market, or they don't care how, you know, how they can save money with, say, our best malts. They're stuck on Weyermann. Well, it's a great product. I can't argue with them. But anyway, when we brought this Danish malt in and blended it, when they were trying it to see if it would work, it's like, oh my God, this is exactly like Weyermann Pilsner at a fraction of the cost. And so we started marketing this Canada malting product called Europils. And especially on the East Coast, it's just really taken off. And on-site brewing here in Anchorage, they came in first in the Alaska Guild meetings last year in the Pilsner category with their Arctic Winds. And that was using mostly our Great West Superior Pils and some Pure Idaho, a great success. And I told them about this Europils. And unfortunately, I didn't pay attention. Yes, it's less expensive than Wireman, but it's way more expensive than Pure Idaho or Superior Pills. And he brought some in and absolutely loved it. And he's brought in pallets several times since. And if his Pilsner wasn't good already, now it's incredible. In fact, he came in fourth in the World Cup, fourth ranked Pilsner in the world with that. So it ended up being a great product, and it was kind of like Arrogant Bastard or a Brown Sugar. It was a mistake, but it ended up great.
Well, that's, I would assume that's got to be one of your big challenges, because malt obviously is pretty bulky. And if you're trying to ship grain from Denmark to Canada to malt it, to then ship the malt to Alaska, just moving it has got to get pretty expensive.
It is. And that was the problem again several years ago. And it was around COVID times or whatever. The shipping rates from Europe were just through the roof and almost cost prohibitive for these guys that were buying, you know, Wireman by the container, whatever. It was just ridiculous. And that's where our domestic sales of kind of the same styles really grew. And surprisingly, the Europills from Canada was ended up and still is less expensive than everything brought from Europe, because it's a blend with Canada malting. Yeah, the way things work up here, our distribution point is Vancouver, Washington. And of course, we have a lot of things coming from Pocatello, Idaho into Vancouver, Washington. Everyone has a freight forwarder in the Seattle area, everyone in Alaska. And so we ship it from Vancouver, Washington to their freight forwarder of choice. And then they handle the shipping up here, which, you know, we all know is just outrageously expensive. When I was on the distributor side, just seeing what the freight for a keg from Seattle, I mean, it was just insane how much that added to the price of things up here. And so grain being so heavy, it's always a scramble trying to find the best way to get things up here.
One final question, what's the barley harvest looking like this year?
You know, it's looking fairly good overall. The I would say it's not great, but it's not bad. It's kind of average in the middle. Some of the growing areas like Montana, maybe North Dakota, South Dakota, I think Saskatchewan, those are not good. But luckily, we don't pull from those. We do some from Saskatchewan, but we've switched more to Alberta. And but especially Idaho is looking really good, the best of all. So Country Malt, Great Western, Canada Malt, we're looking good. Some of our competitors maybe not so much, and they'll have to do some blending like we did and came up with Europill. So you never know.
Well, hey, John, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy day to talk to us about the malt business.
You bet. And one other little side note, because we have conference calls all the time, nationally, sometimes internationally. We're very lucky here in Alaska. Most of the breweries are doing well. Some are doing, you know, just okay, but they're all surviving. Whereas you talk to people in the lower 48 and there's closures every week. That, you know, just aren't, they're just struggling. You know, our guys are all holding in there. I don't know of any even going through COVID that shut down. Well, I know of one that wasn't necessarily COVID, but so good job on you, Alaska breweries.
All righty. Well, again, thanks a lot, John. Really appreciate it. And I'll, if I don't see you before then, I'll see you at the conference in November, man.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
The Nikiski Community Health Fair will be held 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, September 7th at the Nikiski Community Rec Center. Learn about health and wellness from a variety of vendors, make an appointment for mobile mammography, and take advantage of affordable blood screening. Walk-ins are welcome for blood tests, or make an appointment at alaskahealthfair.org. Volunteers are needed. Sign up on the website or call 907-278-0234.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. September is the time for the largest beer festival of them all, Germany's Oktoberfest, plus its numerous imitators. While everyone has heard of Oktoberfest, you may not be familiar with its particulars. What began as a royal wedding celebration in 1810 has grown into the largest beer festival in the world, with about 6 million visitors each year. It's held for the first 2 weeks in September through the first weekend in October in Munich, the capital of Bavaria in southern Germany. The original festival was held in October, hence the name, but was moved forward into September in the 1870s in search of consistently better weather. Which breweries are allowed to have their beers served at the festival is also strictly regulated. Only the 6 large breweries that brew beer within the city limits of Munich are allowed to deliver beer to the festival. Smaller Munich breweries and those from outside the town are strictly banned. While the festival itself takes place in the latter half of September, plenty of breweries around the world have already begun releasing their Oktoberfest-style beers. It is a popular myth that there has only ever been one distinct style of beer brewed for Oktoberfest, but historical evidence shows that there have been many changes in the beers served at the festival. For the first 60 years or so, the then-popular Bavarian Dunkel, a dark lager beer, seems to have been dominant. A shortage of Dunkel during a particularly hot summer in 1872 led to the introduction of the Märzen or Vienna-style lager, which was so popular that it became the dominant style of beer at the festival for over 100 years, eventually earning the name Oktoberfest style. Ironically, changing tastes in the late 20th century has meant that since 1990, all the beers served at the festival have been pale golden Helles lagers rather than the traditional Oktoberfest style. So what is this traditional Oktoberfest beer like? Much of the base malt is the so-called Munich malt, a highly aromatic malt which produces a light amber to nearly brown beer. It's hopped with traditional German hop varieties to produce moderate hop bitterness with little to no hop flavor, coming in at 18 to 24 IBUs. Fermentation using lager yeast produces a clean, rich, toasty, and bready malt flavor with a dry finish that encourages another drink. The overall malt impression is soft, elegant, and complex, with a rich aftertaste that is never cloying or heavy. If you're looking for a local example, St. Elias Brewing frequently offers the style in September, while versions from larger craft brewers in Sierra Nevada and actual imports from Germany are already available in some local liquor stores. When it comes to pairing this beer with food, you'll find that Oktoberfest works well with all sorts of hearty dishes like chili or barbecue brisket. It also pairs well with Caesar salad, macaroni and cheese, apple or pumpkin pie, and even pancakes or waffles. A more unusual pairing, but one that works especially well, is to match this German beer with the Americanized version of a classic Russian dish, beef stroganoff. The brown steak and mushroom flavors have a nice interplay with the beer's caramel malt notes. The rich and creamy sauce matches the toffee notes found in the beer, while the moderate carbonation helps lift the sauce, cleanses the palate, and makes you ready for the next bite. Whether you call it Märzen, Vienna Lager, or Oktoberfest, this classic German style is definitely one of the most popular fall seasonal beers out there and definitely worth seeking out to be enjoyed.
Chill out and heat up your nights with Glacier Blues, your ultimate blues rock experience on KDLL, the heart of the Kenai Peninsula. Every Monday at 7 p.m., we bring you the icy cool sounds of blues rock legends and rising stars, from the soulful strains of B.B. King to the fiery licks of Johnny Winter. Glacier Blues melts your blues away with every note. Feel the passion, embrace the groove, and let the music take you on a journey. Glacier Blues, only on KDLL 91.9 FM, where the coolest blues rock reigns supreme.
Up next, let's do What Bill's Drinking Now. First, an update from last month. I mentioned that Saison DuPont was available in 16-ounce cans at La Bodega in Anchorage. Well, now those same cans are available at Country Liquors in Kenai. So if you'd like to give this excellent brew a try, you can pick it up there. Also newly available at Country Liquors are several brews from Schlenkerla Brewery in Bamberg, Germany. This brewery is world famous for continuing to brew smoked beers long after the rest of the brewing world had given them up. Along with Alaskan Brewing Smoked Porter, these brews were the inspiration for all the smoked beers currently produced by craft brewers around the world. If you like smoke beers and you've never tried these, you really should, given their role in inspiring their modern imitators. There are three styles available locally, a Marzen, a Wiesen, and a Bock. All are excellent, but my personal favorite is the Bock, which is deliciously smooth with plenty of beech smoke flavor. It weighs in at a hefty 6.5% alcohol by volume. Country Liquors is also having a sale on beers from Samuel Smith's Brewery, located at Tadcaster in the United Kingdom. This long-established British brewery offers many different styles, including organic brews and lagers, but I gravitate towards its more traditional ones, which include the Taddy Porter, a Nut Brown Ale, an Oatmeal Stout, an India Pale Ale, and a fantastic Imperial Stout. They also brew some excellent seasonals, but none of them are currently on the shelves. Personally, I try to take advantage of sales like this one to load up on my favorites. I also had some very tasty beers at the Kenai Peninsula Beer Festival. While it was hard to take good notes standing in the rain, here are a few beers that I enjoyed. Bleeding Heart Brewery from Palmer was pouring an excellent winter warmer called All Trash Burns. From Denali Brewing, I sampled both its Double Ender IPA and its Pepper Dog French Saison and thought they were both delicious. Grace Ridge was pouring a beer in the rarely seen Old Brune or Old Brown Belgian style, which was a true delight. I also enjoyed a couple of brews from the People's Choice winner Susitna Brewing, but neglected to write down their names or styles. All in all, there were plenty of excellent beers on offer despite the lousy weather. The week after the festival, I found myself in town with a few minutes to kill, so I stopped at Kenai River Brewing Company for a quick one. I had a glass of the Raven's Rush Baltic Porter. I first tasted this 7% beauty back in 2021, and I'm assuming this is still the same batch because it tasted like it had several years of cold conditioning. It was rich and chewy with the lovely smoothness that long conditioning imparts. Not sure if it is still on tap, but I highly recommend it. Finally, just before taping this show, I was able to score a 4-pack of the new Anchorage Hazy IPA, which I reported on in the beer news segment of this show. While I personally am not a huge fan of this style, this is an excellent example of it, loaded with plenty of juicy hop flavors that suggest tropical fruits. If hazies are your thing, you'll definitely want to check this one out. Well, that's it for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show. Our closing thought is another from that greatest of American philosophers, W.C. Fields, who said, "A woman drove me to drink, and I didn't even have the decency to thank her." Until next month, cheers.
Beers of Alaska, learn about them here. Beers of